This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello and welcome to Powerhouse Politics. I'm ABC News Chief White House Correspondent Jonathan Carl.
And I'm ABC News Political Director Rick Klein.
Rick, we're not going to have one guest today. We're going to have two. We're going to be talking in the second half of the podcast exclusively with Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina. A lot to talk to him about. And we're going to talk to Frank Luntz, who has done a lot of work polling, language, and can tell us just how deep a hole Republicans are in right now. They sure seem to be in a deep hole if you look at the polling. That's what we have. But Rick, first of all, correct me if I'm wrong here, but it sounds like we had Joe Biden not only effectively out on the campaign trail with a major speech, but also, believe it or not, answering questions from real live reporters, including our own Mary Bruce.
That I can confirm that that's true. And I also can confirm that what the president said, that he received the questions in advance, is false. That didn't happen. I know that because Mary's question wasn't given to them in advance.
I mean, what an absurd thing, by the way. Can we please... It's
an effort to try to undermine trust in the press and suggest maybe that debate moderators down the line are going to be helping Biden out. But it's totally reckless. It's totally irresponsible. And it is flat out not true. Not true. But what I thought was intriguing about the Biden appearance, in addition to being the first time in a couple of months that he took questions, is that he was really starting to turn the whole Trump playbook against him. And he was willing to one-up the president on this whole idea of being absent. It was Biden saying, it's you are the one who's absent. Your leadership has not been there. You're the wartime president. You waved the white flag, he says. And going there with when it comes to mental ability, something that the president has been pretty explicit on, Biden's basic thing is, hey, bring that on too.
So let's go through a couple of quick excerpts from the speech. First of all, he addressed this question of the president's credibility, and the president has called himself a cheerleader to explain why sometimes he put the best spin on things when that spin was, well, not exactly true.
We don't need a cheerleader, Mr. President. We need a president, Mr. President. A president who will level with the American people. A president will tell us the unvarnished truth. President will listen to the experts, follow the science, allow them to speak. President will lead.
So, before we go to more Biden, do you mind if I just take a quick detour into what we also heard from Mike Pence? He's been out there. He was out there again yesterday talking about, this alarming increase in coronavirus cases around the country, alarming increase in hospitalizations. Really bad signs, many bad signs, a warning from Anthony Fauci that we could get to the point where we have 100,000 new coronavirus cases a day. So this is kind of what Pence, how he was assessing the current situation as being in a better place.
The American people deserve to know that we're in a much better place today. Thanks to the whole of government approach, the whole of America approach that President Trump initiated at the very outset of the coronavirus.
Now that is like Exhibit A and exactly what Biden's talking about. And I mean, it's really, it's nothing new about Mike Pence. I mean, first of all, he's used that whole of government, whole of America approach, I don't know how many thousands of times since late February when he took over the coronavirus task force. But the effort every time he steps before a microphone and every time the president steps before a microphone, television cameras, is to talk about how great everything is.
And as you've seen, the president not really speaking much before the cameras at all. And it does, I mean, we talk about the audience of one and how important it is for the vice president standing to be in good stead with the president. But that's just not an accurate portrait of where the country is right now. Celebrating the advances and how great the country is doing, it's not the reality. It's also not what people are feeling. We're just not seeing that. We're in polling either, that people are particularly optimistic about this moment. If anything, we've seen it in our polling that people think we're moving too quickly, not too slowly, to reopen.
Now, there was a time in March and April when the president was talking every single day about this, talking about the invisible enemy, and even at one point calling himself a wartime president, does not feel vis-a-vis coronavirus like a wartime president right now. And that is another thing that Biden hit and hit pretty hard in his speech.
Now it's almost July, and it seems like our wartime president has surrendered, waved the white flag, and left the battlefield. Today we're facing a serious threat, and we have to meet it.
So, there he is. He's putting it out there. But I thought, Rick, that one of the more interesting moments came as he got to the end of the part of this where he took questions from the press. And he kept on saying, well, his handlers kept trying to cut it off, and Biden kept on saying, one more question. Okay, one more question. And the final question came from a reporter for Fox News, which went there on basically the central one. I don't know if there is a central allegation that the Trump campaign has really settled on, but one of them is this notion that Biden has somehow lost it. So this is how he addressed the question. The question was put in a way of saying, have you taken a cognitive test to show that you still have the cognitive ability to be president of the United States?
All I got to do is watch me, and I can hardly wait to compare my cognitive capability to the cognitive capability of the man I'm running against.
That was actually a pretty sharp answer, Rick.
It was. And it suggests game on when it comes to the vice president. He's missed it. It's like he has been itching to get back at it, and you couldn't pull him away from the Q&A session. I know in talking to Trump folks in the aftermath, they've been looking for the gaffe. They've been looking for something to glom onto, because their feeling was this was Biden coming out of the basement, that metaphorical basement we've been talking about, and delivering, you know, a pretty strong rebuke and a pretty strong preview. And John, I think we've got a special friend who's joining us right now.
Friend of the podcast?
Getting word that we've got a call in.
Is this Frank Luntz? Frank, how are you? Thanks for joining us.
It's a very interesting time. I've never been through a time like this before, and I can't think of two guys I'd rather talk to than you all.
Interesting and somewhat ominous time. We wanted to check in with you quickly on the state of the race, both in terms of the presidential race and also down ballot House and Senate. It sure seems in the polling like the president is digging a very deep hole, a hole that may be hard for. It's a long way away, 4 months, hard for him to get out of, but perhaps also hard for Republicans in the House and Senate. But I was struck by a tweet he had recently, simply one of these all caps tweets saying, "The Lone Warrior." That does not sound like a great tagline for a campaign trying to win a majority.
It's not, and you're correct. And he used the word warrior to describe his supporters 5 times in Tulsa. And his supporters don't consider themselves warriors. They consider themselves hardworking taxpayers. And it'd be much more effective for him to do something that people who are independent, people who are moderate, would identify with. And I think it's all a part of this hyped up, overly aggressive messaging that is causing him to drop in swing states across the country. I'll give you another example, John. Law and order. When people hear the phrase law and order, I know that Nixon used to use it. But that was 50 years ago, and people see cops beating up protesters on the street, and they don't want that. They do want public safety. They do want to be able to walk around their neighborhoods. The president talked about the silent majority when the public wants someone to represent them, to speak for them, to be their voice, as Trump talked about in his convention speech in 2016. Dominate the streets. All of this language that he's using, by the way, safe and secure streets is what the public wants. All of this language is language that is over-caffeinated, language that's in your face, language that he may want to push, but it is not helping him. And in fact, I can show you in poll after poll, survey after survey, in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, North Carolina, Florida, in swing state after swing state, Trump has dropped 5 points, 10 points, and it's his own fault. It's not that they're turning against him because of what he's doing. They're turning against him because of what he's saying. He's actually, for someone who had a reputation for being a reasonably good communicator, John, he is communicating horribly over the last couple months.
So let me ask you a basic question, a two-part question. How worried are Republicans that you're talking to, House and Senate, trying to you know, keep control of the Senate, trying to keep stem the losses in the House? How worried are they that they're getting dragged down by the president? And the second part of that question is, how worried should they be?
Well, as you know, I'm meeting with Democrats as well as Republicans, and I hear the same thing. They think that having all three branches of government in their control is not just within the realm of possibility, but it's now theirs to lose, that it is unlikely for Republicans to capture more than 5 seats in the House. And in the Senate, that the Democrats now think, I've been in a couple of Democratic offices, that they now think they've got at least a 50-50 shot of capturing the Senate as well. And in states that Republicans have to win the Senate races, they're up for grabs in the presidential race. If Donald Trump does badly in Arizona, that's going to hurt the Arizona Senate candidate. If he does badly in Montana or badly in North Carolina, these are all states that are swing states potentially for the presidential, maybe not Montana, but definitely for the Senate. And I'd say right now there's a 50-50 shot of Democrats winning the Senate.
It's obviously been a terrible spring and early summer for President Trump under any objective measurement of the polls. You know, also in the anecdotals and, you know, the stories that we've done and others have done, talking to former Trump supporters about why they're turning against him and turning to Joe Biden, even if it's somewhat reluctantly. But what's your sense of how permanent the damage is, or how temporary it may be? I mean, 3 months, 4 months, a long time. 4 months ago, the president's reelection prospects looked a heck of a lot different than they do right now. Do you sense anything that he has said that is on his permanent record that voters may not be able to forgive once a fight is fully engaged with Joe Biden?
Well, I think that the conventions are not going to be the panacea that Trump expects them to be. And it's not going to hurt Joe Biden if he accepts his nomination virtually. That the conventions are for the partisans. The conventions are for the political elite, the people who listen to your podcast and those who are already decided whom they're going to vote for. I think that the debates are going to be absolutely essential, and that Donald Trump can come back even if he has a 10-point disadvantage. If Joe Biden performs badly in the debate, and if Donald Trump can change his language, can soften it and show empathy and understanding for the...
Wait a minute, that's a massive if, Frank. I got to
hold on.
Stop
yes,
you there.
Yes, I mean, I agree with that. But what I'm saying, John, is that it's within the realm of possibility and it's within the president's control. Right now, if you held the election today, Joe Biden is the next president. And we all agree on that, and it's clear. And I don't care what they say about the polls in 2016. They were not as inaccurate as Trump people think they were. The fact is that the average Real Clear Politics number in 2016 had Hillary Clinton winning nationwide by 2.9%. What'd she end up winning by? 2.1%. That's only 1% off. That's not only within the margin of error, that's really accurate. 0.8% is accurate, but they didn't have the state by states. And that's why all the major pollsters are now doing these swing state polls. But I think what happens in the debates is that Trump would actually have to have a, and I don't know how to say this and not be insulting, and I do not wish to be, but he's going to have a brain fart, a senior moment. I don't know what the phrase is. But if he has two of them, not one, because one everybody has over a 90 minute when you know that there are 50 or 70 million people from across the globe watching you, you can go down. You can forget what you're going to say. But if Biden were to have two of them within a 90-minute debate, and Trump were to challenge him on it, you could see a flip in the election.
Frank, you mentioned something interesting a little bit earlier about how voters view themselves and the sense of what these words, what the terminology means. And I'm wondering if there's something about this unique moment that makes that even more important. The fact that this is the crisis of COVID-19, the economic collapse that surrounds that, the national reckoning over race relations, these are things that people are living and seeing and breathing. This is not some abstract thing. This isn't a war that for the most part is fought by others. Or, you know, since not even, you know, a regional economic collapse. This is around the country. Everyone is feeling this in the same way. And I just wonder, with a president that's so used to being able to define his own realities, how that plays into it. The fact that Americans feel this and are in this, if not together, they're sharing the experience of these unbelievably huge crises.
And that's why I've always been impressed with your analysis. Because you identified the three moments that we are having. You've identified what Trump does not seem to be empathizing with. Any one of these would not just be the story of the year, it'd be the story of the half decade. Having two of them would be the story of the decade. Having all three of them combined, this is the most significant year since 1968. This is the greatest trauma that this country has faced since then. And when you have an economic trauma, when you have a social trauma, and you have a healthcare trauma, all three of them, arguably, this is more significant than 68. And I do not believe that Donald Trump knows how to communicate that. And again, this is not a focus on policy. I'm a language guy. I'm a communications guy. And he doesn't get that people are afraid. And I remember in the press conferences, and John, you used to take an awful lot of abuse from the president. He would rip into you repeatedly. But I don't think he understood that the questions you were asking are questions that the American people were asking. Where are we going to be a month from now, 6 months from now? Is my family in jeopardy? Is my job in jeopardy? Is my community in jeopardy? These are legitimate questions that he felt he didn't need to answer, or he would just dismiss them. And that put him on the wrong side of the public. And he's going to have, by the way, if he doesn't change, if he says, I'm going to do it my way because I won in 2016, you all were wrong about me. You all did not see what I see or did not hear what I hear. If he does that, then I think that we are headed to a historic loss. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you're going to pull me on the week after the election and say, Frank, why did you not see Trump's comeback? But unless he changes his tone, he's going to need one hell of a comeback. Come October.
Frank, before you go, one last question on Biden. There's an argument, and it's arguably the way he's run his campaign so far, although there have been other factors. There's an argument that when you have somebody who is doing, you're running against, who has done exactly what you have described, and who is beating himself and beating himself effectively, that, you know, Biden might as well basically lie low and watch Donald Trump implode and win election that way, and do all he can to stay out of it and let this be a referendum on Donald Trump. There's another argument, which I've made to Rick, and I'll make now, that Biden should be out there, and he should be out there more, and he should be engaging with the press. He should be doing what he did yesterday. Frequently taking questions. He should be doing interviews. He should be doing interviews with people that are not just friendly, but are going to ask tough questions. I'd put him on Fox News. Because first of all, he's got to be at the top of his game going into the fall. He is going to have, we expect, three debates with Donald Trump. You got to be used to it. You got to be out there. You got to be in it. We've seen over and over again, politicians who think they are in a great spot try to run out the clock and have it blow up on them. I mean, we saw Hillary Clinton arguably do that twice, 2008 and 2016. We saw Jeb Bush do that in 2016. So what do you think? You're advising Joe Biden. You've advised other candidates over the years. If you were advising Joe Biden, would you say, lay low, you know, avoid places where you may, you know, get a question that throws you off course? Or would you tell him, go out there?
Why would you tell Joe Biden to participate in a media interview when the questioner is going to ask a question for, I don't know, 8-10 minutes, and maybe you get a sentence or two to respond? That's number one. Number two is, I'd say to Joe Biden, do not hire Jonathan Carl. because he's going to put you in jeopardy every single day. If you hire Jonathan Carl, and I don't know, maybe you're on the payroll already. It seems like the press like him so much that he's buying them off.
Come on, Frank.
No, no, John. I'm asking,
So you say he should play it safe. You say he should play it safe, avoid interviews, don't do a lot of press conferences, let Trump destroy himself and win by lying low.
Of course you're going to use that kind of framing. But no, Joe Biden should be out there once a month. He should be engaging in tough interviews.
So four times between now and November.
With MSNBC and CNN. He should be... And on your programs, that he should go where he knows that he's going to receive a challenge about as tough as a kid's show. Now, obviously, I'm kidding about that. I do not need, Joe does not need, yeah, John, if you're going to ask a three-minute question, you're going to get that kind of response. Joe does not need to engage with people like you, quite frankly, because you'll hold them accountable and Rick will rip them apart. He's, when you've got this kind of lead and you've got a president who's so unpopular, I think it was Lee Atwater who said back in the 1980s when he was George Bush's mastermind, when your opponent's in the process of destroying themselves, let them. If they set themselves on fire, don't put it out. And I think it's not good for the democracy. It's not good for who we are as a country, but as a political strategist, if that's the hat I have right now, then I do think that it is better for Biden to lay low, at least until September. John, the first debate is not until September 29th. The first debate is not for 3 months. Why jeopardize a lead that is growing just because a few reporters want to ask you a few questions?
Okay, so I will take the side of the American public and American democracy over the side of the political consultant class anytime. And I would argue with you, and I will let you go on this answer to your answer, that Joe Biden was very shaky in his first debates for the Democratic nomination and showed and hurt his standing. He got significantly better as it went on because he was in the arena. He was not, you know, he didn't have to blow the dust off him and put him out there and suddenly he's got to take, you know, play in the big leagues. So, you know, I get him out there. What's he afraid of? And the American people deserve it. They deserve a candidate who's going to answer some questions.
And John, I'll just take the side of Frank Luntz. I'll take the side of Frank Luntz, who said that he said he's impressed with Rick Klein's analysis and would not hire John Carl for anything. So that feels like I feel like he's asked and answered all of our questions appropriately today. Thank you, Frank.
All right, Frank Luntz, even when you insult us, we like having you on because we think we can learn something from you, all right?
Yeah,
even when you're wrong.
I'm only insulting you, John. Rick is still 100%.
Thank you, Frank. We are going to take, and by the way, I'll address that after you hang up. We are going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Powerhouse Politics and Senator Tim Scott. Welcome back to Powerhouse Politics. We are joined now by Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina. Senator Scott, thank you for joining us.
It's good to be with you, John. Good to hear your voice again.
Always a pleasure to talk to you. I wanted to ask you about this. We're still learning more, the story about the Russian, alleged Russian bounties on American troops paid to the Taliban. The president tweeted suggesting that this whole thing is a hoax again. I assume you've looked into this. I mean, what is your sense?
Well, listen, I have as much information. I'm going to take a look at some of the classified documents later today. But my understanding is a simple one that in the end, I had dinner with Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe a couple nights ago, one of my best friends in Washington. And I'd just say that I think the White House seems to have put national security interest above their interest, and I think that's the way it should be. Bottom line is I have no information that tells me that they've done anything that would be inconsistent with what we would want to happen. I saw the post by Senator Lindsey Graham that says the president was briefed, and I have not heard anything that is contrary to that. I will say that if, in fact, the Russians have placed a bounty on any heads, there should be decisive, aggressive action against the Russians, and we just need to run that to ground.
But let me ask you, though. I mean, the president's tweet on this morning is entirely dismissive of the story. I mean, he's saying it's a hoax. And I'm seeing people like Senator Sasse come out talking about how he's hearing from military families in Nebraska and that they are livid about this. I see Liz Cheney coming out of a briefing on this, saying that there have got to be serious consequences. The story is being taken very seriously by many of your colleagues. It does not seem to be taken seriously by the president of the United States, at least on his Twitter feed, and we certainly haven't seen anything from him in public. And the White House has not delivered the message you just delivered, that if this is true, the Russians have to pay consequences.
Yeah, John, and I'm not going to sit here and try to explain the White House. I don't work at the White House. I don't work for the White House. I work for America. And I think if it's proven that Russia in any way, shape, or form made it more difficult for our men and women in theater to survive, there should be a high premium and an aggressive response or reaction to that situation. And what the White House says in response to that is something I don't control and I don't always follow. So at the end of the day, I would just say that my perspective is that we should take a very clear position on this important issue.
I'm curious your thoughts, though, on this. The defense authorization bill does include language in it that would force the Department of Defense to rename bases that are that are named after Confederate soldiers, Confederate generals. The president issued a veto threat on that today. Says he'd veto it. It's in the legislation as being crafted in both the House and the Senate. Do you see any possibility of it coming out? And is it to your mind, is that something that Congress needs to work around, knowing that the president is issuing this veto threat? Is that something that needs to be accommodated at this point, or do you think that language should stay?
Well, you all follow the president's tweets better than I do. I would say that my perspective is, talking to members of the SASC, Tom Cotton and others, the willingness for the DOD to study the names of the bases, I think, makes sense to me. How we come to the conclusion on bases that should be renamed, if at all, is a part of that process that we should study. I think that we should move forward with the language basically as it is, from my understanding, which is that we should have a study of those bases and why they were named, and then come to a conclusion on what we should do about that. And I think it's premature to make a decision before you see the results of the study. Something that I'm interested in seeing.
You were over the weekend in an unusual position where you did an interview in that in the window of time where the president's retweet of the supporter yelling "White Power" was still up, and you took, I think, an admirable position in saying that it should be taken down, and in fact the president did take it down a few hours later. I'm curious, from where you sit, you know, why that felt like a moment that you needed to weigh in, and what the process was like. Did you have other communications with the White House about it, or was it just the interview and the ability to speak out on that moment? If there was something special about this that you felt like this is a tweet that's worth responding to.
I think my responsibility as it relates to the president's tweets, once again, I don't follow them like you guys follow these tweets. But what I will say is, when Jake Tapper sent me the tweet about 5 minutes before I went on the air, that to me, it's just, you have to use common sense more than political instinct when it comes to making decisions of consequence. And from my perspective, the common sense approach to the president's retweet at that time was not even a question. If it's indefensible, it's indefensible. So just take it down. Whether the president actually saw the video in full or not is in question. But whether or not he should take it down was not a question from my perspective, and one that I spoke clearly about. And I'm thankful that the White House responded fairly quickly. And I've spoken out on a number of occasions, frankly, on things that I disagree with. And I think that to do it with respect is important, but to do it unwaveringly is equally as important.
So I to move from the president's tweets, and I am tempted to ask you about.
I'm applauding you, Dr. Rubio, for the president's tweets. If I don't control what he does, yes. But thank you.
Yes, yes, yes. Let's move on to something that you do have some degree of control over, and that is your police reform legislation, obviously
yes,
blocked by the Democrats. You had said that there, I think you told me on this week, that there's basically 70% of agreement between your bill and the Democratic bill in the House. Your bill has been blocked. Can you do something? Are there bits and pieces that can be taken out of your bill that you can reach out to your Democratic colleagues and get passed? Or are we just going to have to wait till after the election on this?
Well, I think the worst the worst outcome is to wait until after the election on the legislation that I sponsored, mostly because it just sends such a terrible message to kids who face the same situation that I faced 18 times being stopped by law enforcement. But more importantly, I think about the single parents, so often the single mothers who are waiting for their kids to come home from a shift at work or hanging out with friends. I never realized how much pressure and weight was on my mother's shoulders as she waited patiently for me to come in the house before she went to sleep. And I just did not understand that weight until really recently as we discussed some of the issues. But more importantly, I would say this, that when you have so much in common from a base bill perspective, you should look for ways forward. I spent over an hour yesterday meeting with Karen Bass, the person who really led the charge on the police reform bill in the House. And she and I had a wonderful conversation, a cordial conversation. And frankly, I was more encouraged at the end of our conversation than I was when I went into the conversation. I hope that over the next couple of weeks that she will have an impact on some of the friends that she has in the Senate on the Democrat side. Because from a notification perspective, the two bills are very similar. They want more information below the serious bodily injury than I do, that's something that we could actually work towards together. We both want to find a way to recruit more minority officers. We do it one way, they do it a different way, but that's another area of strong agreement. The use of body cameras, I have been working on this for more than 5 years. So the reality of having body cameras and the funding to go with body cameras, this is an area where we agree. I have penalties for not having your body cameras when it leads to serious bodily injury or death. When it comes to record preservation, they have a state database. The president's executive order has a national database. We preserve the records so that those records go to the state base or the national database. That's another area of commonality or congruence. On de-escalation training and best practices, these are areas where we're in the same place. Anti-lynching bill. I've got it passed through the Senate twice. They wanted to rename it in the House, then send it back. They flirted with disaster, and now we don't have an anti-lynching bill. That's in the bill. That's another area of commonality. Use of force review boards. I want to study it a little bit more so we can get to best practices. They want to go straight to it. I think we get to a place where we actually have that. We saw become law just recently, or at least it passed the Senate unanimously. The Commission on Black Men and Black Boys, which was a part of the bill that's now heading towards the House. So the duty to intervene grants to trained folks, another area of commonality. So the truth is, when you have that much in common, all of that not getting to the neighborhoods and to the police departments to encourage better behavior, that would be a shame for us to stop short of getting that done. And frankly, even on qualified immunity, I'm not in a position where I'm going to negotiate on officers, but I am in a position to negotiate other parts of the conversation and where we make it easier for restitution and for recourse for families to sue cities and counties and departments. That's something that I think is actually a positive and not a negative. So even on that very sensitive issue, there are working groups on both sides of the aisle. So there is a reason for us to keep our shoulder to the grindstone for the next few weeks and see if we can emerge from this time back in our states with a compromise bill that leads to the president's signature. If we miss this opportunity, it won't be for the lack of effort on my part, and it won't be because every member of the United States Senate Republicans were willing to move forward and give Democrats
enough amendments to vote on every single difference they saw in the bill.
Hey, quickly, by means of follow-up, Senator, the slogans have been quite something in this, and I wonder your take on this. You know, the president this morning saying that Black Lives Matter is a symbol of hate. Do you feel like the slogans around defund the police and the like have hampered the efforts to actually get something done?
Well, I will say this is my last question on the president. I will answer, number one. I'm not here to defend and or comment on what he does or doesn't say. I think that's a path forward that is fraught with problems because I don't work for the president. I work for the American people. I do not find the Black Lives Movement as the words themselves as problem or hateful themselves. I think the concept of defunding the police is a position of stereotyping all law enforcement officers in the same way that I, as an African American, would hate to be stereotyped because I have been stereotyped. So I'm going to fight against stereotyping any people groups, whether they wear blue or whether they're born in black. So that's just a position I'm going to always defend. And the question about the value of life is best answered in a New York City park when the woman said she's going to call the law enforcement on a Harvard-educated black man simply because he asked her to follow the rules of the park. That told me that she instinctively understood that her position of power, especially in the eyes of law enforcement, was superior to the man that she threatened to call the police on.
All right, Senator Scott, last question. It is not about the president. It's a big question. And before I get to it, I want to read something that you that you said a while back. You it was actually on our podcast right before the inauguration in 2017. You said there's an old scripture. This is what you told us on the Powers Politics. There's an old scripture in the book of Matthew that says, love your neighbor. Now, I would hope as leaders, we would look for ways to bring this country together from the president of the United States down to every member of Congress to leaders of households and at the state level as well. And I see that message, and I think that is a message that could resonate very strongly today. And I had a conversation over the weekend with a very senior Republican in Congress about who the leading contenders would be for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination. In other words, who is next? And this person said, without missing a beat, Tim Scott. So here's my question. Does Tim Scott, I know you've talked about possibly going and becoming a pastor after you leave the Senate. Would you consider him? Have you considered? Do you think it's a possibility you would run for president of the United States?
Well, my mission is to positively impact the lives of a billion people with the message of hope. Have a lot to do with my faith and opportunity, the lessons of financial literacy that I learned from my mentor. I would say that what you referred to was Matthew 7:12. So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you, for this sums up the law and the prophets. The best way for us to fulfill our destiny as a nation is to love one another in the same way that we would want to be loved, to treat each other in the same way that we would want to be treated. The question that I always try to answer is, can I do all that I can where I am, and is that good enough? And when the answer is yes, I continue to do it right where I am. So I can't predict the future. What I can tell you is I think that it's easier to have a healthy reputation and a higher approval rating as a member of the clergy than it is as a member of politics. So my future is unknown to me, but I don't have any designs today on running for president of the United States. I think the best thing to do is be as qualified at what you're doing and as dedicated at what you're doing, and don't think beyond tomorrow, because today has enough problems for me just this day. And frankly, the hate that I have received and the death threats and all of the things that have come up because I've worked on a bipartisan piece of legislation to make it safer in neighborhoods doesn't make me want to roll back my commitment on term limits in public office, and especially in the United States Senate. So I am thankful to be where I am. I am hopeful that God's not finished with me yet, but to look that far down the road would be something that I'm not planning that far down the road. I'm planning for tomorrow.
Well, there's a lot of wisdom in that, and I hope you won't mind then, because I definitely did not hear a no in there, but if Rick Klein and I, as we look forward, we always do this, we always look to the next election, that we include Tim Scott on our list of potential candidates in 2024.
Until he takes it off. Thank you, Senator.
If you want it off, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and we'll talk to you again soon. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you, Senator.
So Rick, seriously, I definitely did not hear a no on the presidential question, but it's very early. But I will tell you that this was a rather prominent, very prominent Republican in Congress who did not miss a beat in saying that Tim Scott's the guy that the Republicans should put forward in the post Donald Trump era. Now, God only knows, but interesting.
And I think in the context of how he thinks about these, I mean, he quoted scripture with us a couple of years ago and was ready to quote scripture again today. And we should say that the stuff that he has been facing online is disgusting. It is atrocious. It's repulsive. And anyone in public life, we're used to getting a lot of online vitriol. I think a black Republican in Donald Trump's America, the only black Republican in the United States Senate, gets it way worse. And to me, at least, Tim Scott feels it. He gets it. He hears it. It's hard to tune that out. And the question of what you want to put yourself, your family through in pursuing the presidency has got to be a real one. But you're right. It's not a question of ruling it out. And I think the party post-Trump, win or lose, is going to be in a really interesting place. It can go in a lot of different directions. And it's hard for me to imagine there not being interest in Senator Scott pursuing something around another elected office. Whether it's top of mind for him or not, it's going to be out there.
Well, I'm sure we'll be talking to him again before too long. I think one of the more interesting people in public life, and I think we learn from him when we have him on the podcast. Rick, that is all the time we have now. I don't know where Trevor Hastings is, but we somehow managed to do this show without him. Susie Liu did a phenomenal job as the acting senior chief major producer of this podcast. And of course, Avery Miller, we wouldn't do it without her, because we couldn't. Am I right?
We couldn't. We actually couldn't. You're exactly right about that, John.
All right. We'll be back next week with Powerhouse Politics.